is next.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Peter Aykroyd's London breathes and churns. It morphs and mutates. It is a city, a character, that is both louche and drab, mysterious and cunning. The London of Peter Aykroyd's reverie and reality guards secrets and lies, harbors the wicked, plays host to excess, and bears witness to history. It is a massive and indifferent Babylon where fog creeps up on the noonday sun and where a wilderness of roofs and tenements once hid the private torment of a people who made it the suicide capital of Europe. But Peter Aykroyd's London is a paradox, a colossus so inviting in its vastness, it is overwhelmingly, stiflingly grand. A metropolis that heaves and crackles with an energy that inspires and burns. This is Peter Aykroyd's London, and he wouldn't have it any other way. And in London, the Biography, Aykroyd introduces us to the great monster he calls home in all its raucous, raunchy, resplendent glory. Connection listeners, what is the London that you know? Do you recognize it in the flesh and blood body of Peter Aykroyd's description? Would you cast London as a hero, a villain, or something in between? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And I am joined from London now by Peter Aykroyd, author of London, the Biography. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Now, you have lived in this city most of your life, am I right?
I was born here, and I've lived here, apart from spells and universities, yes, and until my present date.
Now, often people who have been such a long time in the same place are the people who are least enamored of it, the people who don't notice the skylines, who take the history for granted. Why are you different?
I don't think I'm that different. I think most Londoners do have a sense of their city and of its history. Certainly they have an abiding awareness of its presence in their lives. But in my own case, it's become almost the landscape of my imagination, if that's not too pretentious a phrase. In all my novels and biographies, it features almost as a character like any other character. And it seemed to me just and interesting and appropriate to try and investigate the city as if it were a human being with its own destiny.
So it's very much the landscape of my imagination as well for all the literature that we consume as children, as adults, that have London at or near the center. But so much of that, because it's written by the ruling class or put in condensed little history chapters, deals with the progression of monarchs and the aristocracy and the ruling class. You quite specifically chose not to take that look at the city.
Yes, indeed. London has always been of an egalitarian and democratic and even radical temper. The kings and queens, as you say, who pass by, have had very little to do with the history or the fabric of the city. It's always been a city of its people, of its citizens, and has very little to do with what you call the ruling class. They have more or less remained strangers and aliens to the life of the capital. And what I wanted to do in this book was to, as it were, reveal the secret history of London, to understand its byways, its darknesses, its underground passages, in a manner which has probably not been done before.
I wonder if I can ask you to read a little bit from the first chapter. This is the one called The Sea, when you're just getting us introduced to London. Do you know the one I mean?
I do indeed. I'll just read a very short paragraph from it. London has always been a vast ocean in which survival is not certain. The dome of St. Paul's has been seen trembling upon a vague, troubled sea of fog, while dark streams of people flow over London Bridge or Waterloo Bridge and emerge as torrents in the narrow thoroughfares of London. The social workers of the mid-19th century spoke of rescuing drowning people in Whitechapel or Shoreditch, and Arthur Morrison, a novelist of the same period, invokes a howling sea of human wreckage crying out to be saved. That's just from the very first chapter of the book, which in a way explores London's origins, as it were, beneath the prehistoric seas, where the signs of that abiding moment in its history still remain in the stones and rocks of the city.
When you set us up to understand the city, Peter, you describe it as a human body. Was this a method of organizing your thoughts about the city which came to you in the writing of the book, or have you always sort of felt that it had that pulsing sense of a live body?
It always has had, for me, that sense of a living organism. It would have been possible, I suppose, to write the book as a kind of triptych, physical, spiritual, and mental activities of the city. But instead, what I tried to do was just trace various themes through time so that, for example, we could have a history of light and a history of silence, a history of stone, or a history of fog. So instead of writing a chronological study in which the centuries would pass by as if in a stream, I wanted to write something which was more direct and which I think addressed the abiding qualities of London more successfully.
Take that a little bit further, because it has to do with why you chose to title the book The Biography instead of History or Almanac. Or, I mean, at times it reads almost like a guest book of an old public house. But why the biography?
Well, I suppose partly because that's what I do some of the time, write biographies. And for me, I thought of it in similar terms, or let me say I approached the subject in the same way that I approach the subjects of Thomas More, Charles Dickens, William Blake, T.S. Eliot, whomever I've written about. My way of acquiring information, of understanding the processes of the city, was in a sense a psychological one rather than an archaeological one. I wanted to try to understand the passions of the city, the secrets of the city, the obsessions of the city, in a way which one would try to understand them in the fate of any other human being.
Are you as enchanted with the names of the city as those of us who don't call it home? I'm thinking of the chapter in about halfway through the book, you call it Black Magic, White Magic, and one of the lines goes, the cemetery garden behind the Hawksmoor Church of St. George in the East, beside Wapping, attracts the lonely and the unhappy. The garden of another church, Christ Church, Spitalfields, by chance, by the same architect, was for many years a resting place for the vagrant and the deranged. It was known as Itchy Park. And on it goes through these, just the names which sing to me. And I'm wondering if I get that pleasure as an outsider, or you take the same joy in it.
Oh, I take a great deal of pleasure in the names of London. Some of them are obscene, some of them are funny, some of them are sad. It's the names, in a way, often refer us back to the original meaning of the city. We have a bread lane and a milk lane next to each other. We have a Friday Street because it sold fish, and fish was bought on Fridays. And those names echo back to early medieval times and still exist. In a way, it's a token of the way the city itself has survived.
There's a chapter that you write on Clerkenwell Green, which to me reads almost like a piece of investigative journalism. And I'm wondering, in your research for this one little area of London, did you spend a lot of time on the street looking? Did you spend a lot of time in the books researching the history of Clerkenwell Green?
Oh, yes. Clerkenwell Green has been one of the magic places to me throughout my life. And it's something which I've tried to explore in other books, actually. But in this case, in the case of the book upon London, I was very interested and intrigued and almost possessed by the idea that Clerkenwell as an area has been the home of radical political activity for almost 1,000 years. Marx came there, Lenin came there, Wat Tyler came there, the Chartists came there, the Fenians came there. It's as if one little patch of ground can exert an influence, can create a pattern of behavior, a pattern of habitual conduct in ways which we don't yet understand. So for me, the research into Clerkenwell was a research into the unknown powers of the earth almost.
And when you call it the Shadowland, when you're referring to Clerkenwell, when you're weaving it into the history and the present, I'm going back to where we began. I'm wondering whether or not you get a sense that the people who inhabit that London today are as aware as your book explains, of how much they are living on the stones of so many years ago.
Some are, and I've when I give talks or lectures, invariably people come up to me and say, well, I always had that sense about the place where I live, or did you know about this about the place where I live? So there are some people who are genuinely and passionately attached to the territory in which they live. Other people, of course, pay no attention to it and just regard the history as something long gone and done. But the real Londoner, for me, is one who understands the forces which make him or her exist, because the real Londoner understands that he's part of 1,000 generations of citizens who have come before him.
Now, you're a storyteller. That's your art as a writer. But perhaps I should preface my next question by having you introduce us to Mrs. Lucen, the woman in Clerkenwell Green who chooses not to bathe, if I have her right.
Ah, yes. I found so many interesting women in Clerkenwell. Did you want me to read that passage?
Just to tell me about her, if you like. I mean, maybe perhaps reading it would be best. That's up to you. I just, as I would go through an exploration of the smell of London or the tobacco of London, was always these characters that leapt off the page that you've discovered.
Yes, there are. It's full of characters who have now completely vanished from the pages of ordinary history. And that was one of the joys of researching and writing this book, was to rescue those who had been completely forgotten and yet who at the time seemed to embody the spirit of London itself, whether we're talking about the vagrants or whether we're talking about the colourful beggars, or whether we're talking about the eccentric women like the one you mentioned who never bathed and always wore white. All these people seem to me to represent some essence of London, some quintessence of London, and it was a great joy to be able to revive them, even in the pages of just this one book.
Now, in the American edition, Mrs. Lucen appears on page 465. I'm not sure whether or not it's the page numbering is the same in the British edition.
I think it probably is. No, it's not, actually.
All right.
I can't find it offhand. But,
all right. It's about half a dozen pages into into chapter 51.
Right.
If you can flip through it and
I'll try and find it. What I would say about her is that she is one of those characters who seem to have entered almost the subconsciousness of London. I don't know if you know the character of Miss Havisham in Charles Dickens's Great Expectations.
I love Miss Havisham.
The old woman in white who lures Pip into his fate with Estella. But the woman in white is a creature almost of the London streets. There are many examples of these old ladies who sort of shut themselves away from the world as if the horrors of London were too much to be borne.
Storing the stove ash or whatever they do.
And living in sort of cloistered, anchorite-like territories.
Does it matter to you, Peter, that some of them are fictional and some of them are not?
No, not at all. I don't believe there's very much distinction to be drawn between fiction and fact in terms of London. There is something called an urban vision, or a Cockney vision, to put it more precisely. The vision is shared by Charles Dickens and by William Blake in particular, but also shared by painters like Turner, where the real becomes the sublime, the naturalistic becomes the mythical by some process of urban alchemy, where individual lives become symbolic of much greater forces.
Connection listeners, is Peter Ackroyd's London the London that you know? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we are talking with Peter Ackroyd, author of London, the biography.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the underworld. Come out of the cupboard, you boys and girls. London calling, now don't look to us. Phony Beatlemania has bitten the dust. London calling, see we ain't got no swing except for the rain and the crunch of...
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour, my guest is Peter Ackroyd, author of London, the Biography.
Fog everywhere. Fog up the river where it flows among green meadows. Fog down the river where it rolls defiled among the tears of shipping and the waterside pollutions of a great and dirty city. Fog on the Essex marshes, fog on the Kentish heights. Fog creeping into the cabooses of collier brigs, fog lying out on the yards and hovering in the rigging of great ships. Fog in the eyes and throats of ancient Greenwich pensioners, wheezing by the firesides of their wards. Chance people on the bridges, peeping over the parapets into a nether sky of fog, with fog all round them, as if they were up in a balloon and hanging in the misty clouds.
There's a treat for you, Connection listeners. That is Peter Ackroyd, biographer of Charles Dickens, reading from Charles Dickens, Bleak House, A Description of Fog. You really like this guy's writing. I can tell when I hear you read him.
Yes, he's always been for me a great inspiration and example. He was not born in London, actually. He was born in Portsmouth, but he came to London at a very early age and never really left it in spirit. He was oppressed by London. His first experience of London was working in a blacking factory and a prison where his father was incarcerated for debt. So his formative experiences of London were of its darkness, of its oppression. And that's one very central aspect of London, which is often forgotten. It has always been a dark city, which has oppressed its citizens.
And is part of that darkness in your mind, Peter, the fog that is so much a part of the fiction of the city as well as our understanding of its past?
Yes, the fog, I suppose you could say, is a metaphysical token, a sign of the real nature of the city. You have to remember that London was founded 2,000 years ago as a place to make money, as a place of commerce, a place of trade, and it's never, ever lost that origin. Now the city of London, so-called, the little bit in the middle of London, is devoted to trade in exactly the same spots and on the same sites where the Romans first founded their own commercial premises. So it's always been a commercial city. It's a city built upon money, upon trade, upon finance, upon power. It's not a humane or civilized city in that sense, and it has always borne the traces of its origin in that respect.
As a resident of London, do you ever feel that same sense of oppression that Dickens describes from his early days there?
Not, of course, as Dickens did, because Dickens came into the city at the moment when it turned from an 18th century city into a vast megalopolis. It was the first megalopolis in the world, and in some respects it was the most... made the most exorbitant demands upon its citizens. It was the largest city in the world, the most heavily populated city in the world. Engels and Marx came here to see what industrial civilization was going to be like. So in that sense, I can't really share Dickens' experience. What I do find, though, is the oppression of the city after so long a history has almost a comforting presence. It's as if so much has suffered and happened here that one's own personal griefs are of no particular account. So if I'm in a depressed or irritable mood, all I have to do is start walking the streets of London, and immediately my private feelings are subdued by a more general sense and a more numinous sense of the city's rich history.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to Providence, Rhode Island, and Chris is joining us. Hello, Chris.
Hi. Actually, I think Peter just started to touch on a question that I had, which also was set off by the music and the segue out to the break, which was the Clash's London Calling. In the last 20 years or so, particularly since Margaret Thatcher was prime minister, the city's been the site of a lot of class tension and class war. I was just there a couple of months ago and couldn't afford to be in the city for the first time. And it made me wonder how the entrance of the city into the list of the very small number of the world's most expensive cities changes the way that Peter's thinking about the city presently.
Well, the city has always been divided between the rich and the poor. It's always been a city of contrasts and clashes. And when you talk about the present cultural climate, it's really just an expression of what has always been London's manifest destiny as a place of sheer inequality, where money and power speak and where poverty is silenced. The clashes you describe have echoed down its history from the demonstrations and strikes strikes of the 19th century to the riots of the 14th century and the 15th century. So it's a continuing pattern of civil disorder in a city which thrives, in a way, upon inequality and upon grievances.
You devote an entire chapter to the Gordon riots, which I claim no responsibility for, but doing exactly that, saying that in whatever it was, the late 1700s, that these were the riots of the people rampaging through the city in many ways, as we've seen on the news in the last 10 years, yes. Disaffected urban youth turning over cars and rioting in places north of London.
Yes, it's always been an incendiary city in many respects. Not only has it often been visited by fire and has burnt down almost entirely several times, only to be rebuilt, but it's incendiary in the sense that its citizens are quick to anger, quick to resentment, easily roused by insurrectionaries. The metaphor for London often is that it resembles a prison. And there are times when you see these riots when you think of the people on the streets as somehow prisoners trying to beat helplessly against their bars.
Back to Chris in Providence. I just wonder, one of the joys for me in reading Peter's description was putting it in that broader historical context. Do you think we sometimes lack that when we make up our mind about what's going on in the world by just watching the news and reading today's paper?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's exactly the benefit of a book like this. And it reminds me a lot of, actually, the way he's speaking reminds me a lot of a book by Greil Marcus called Lipstick Crisis, which isn't focusing so much on a city, but rather on a set of tendencies in which those same sorts of issues get invoked through the worlds of avant-garde art and music. What strikes me about what Peter's saying is the extent to which the city, I mean, in the interim between my proposing the question and listening, he spoke about the extent to which the city was founded on a set of financial and merchant principles, which means by its very definition that the city will always be engaging with those sorts of things. And I think it's a compelling argument.
Thanks for your call, Chris.
Thank you.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now Peter's joining us. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Well, what I was very struck by just listening to this is the aspect of music, and where composer Vaughan Williams wrote a symphony called the London Symphony back around 1910, 1911. And the movements are literally deal with the very things Mr. Aykroyd is talking about the emotions and the movement of a great city, where it deals with the early morning, then suddenly the hustle and bustle, and another movement deals with the quiet of byways and gray passages. Another movement deals with nightlife, and the fourth deals with just an overall dramatic picture of the city itself, and then very gradually receding into midnight as the Thames flows towards the sea.
Peter Aykroyd, do you see the city in those musical terms of Vaughan Williams?
Certainly, I know that symphony, and it's a variety, its melodic variety and its pace accurately embody or reflect or represent the heterogeneity and pace of the city itself. You might almost say that London is a collection of contrasts. It has no meaning as such. Its meaning lies in its endless birth of meanings. It's a complex, endlessly creative, endlessly renewed, endlessly resourceful place which can't be pinned down to any one theme or topic. That's, I suppose, why in this book I ranged so widely over a variety of different subjects, principally because it was the only way I could comprehend the copiousness of a city which is continually dying and continually being reborn.
Peter in Cambridge, The people here in the on the other side of the glass tell me that you've got a little bit of that music we can listen to.
I do. It's a fragment of the First Symphony. The performance is with the London Philharmonic with Sir Adrian Boult, who in fact led one of the earlier performances. And it's an LP, so forgive it if it pops a little.
Just a few seconds.
I'll just let the needle down so you can hear it, and I'll bring the phone up close, okay?
Sure.
Okay, bear with me for a moment. There you go.
Thanks for that treat.
Buy his book, and also you might get the Vaughan Williams Symphony and listen to it while you're reading the book.
What a good idea. Peter Aykroyd, you were going to say something here.
I was just going to say, even in those few brief chords, you sense some of the mystery and melancholy which the city seems to induce in certain people.
Peter Aykroyd, we need to talk a little bit about drinking. It is the morning, I know, at least in the United States. But I had a lot of fun with your tracing of the 20,000 public houses that had been sort of officially registered in the mid 1800s.
That's right. It's always been a city of drunken people. In the 14th century, a chronicler said London was a great place, except for the number of fires and the incidents of drunken fools. And drink has always been inseparable to the city's life, in a good sense and in a bad sense. In a good sense, it represents the communal life of the city, the conviviality of a city, which is largely based upon conversation. The coffee house culture of the 18th century was succeeded by the pub culture of the 19th and 20th centuries. But also it's got a bad side in the sense that people who are drunk are more prone to violence, more prone to rage. And those are exactly the qualities which foreign observers observed in London citizens. Their readiness to react violently to events. And also drink is a form of forgetfulness. And there are those whose life in the city was so unhappy and so deprived that they literally drank in order to forget their existence, in order to forget the urban conditions which had been imposed upon them.
Now, you tell me about a drink here that I'd never heard of before, the salup, I think. I'm not sure if I've got the pronunciation.
A salup, I can't remember what that is now.
This is the hot, sweet beverage made from sassafras wood, milk and sugar. But
yes,
they were always searching. I can't believe you've forgotten something. It's a very short book you've got here, Peter.
I forget. It's a very long book, I'm afraid, and it's almost impossible for one human being to recall every single detail of
Indeed.
That sort of thing. Sassafras was a sort of that wasn't an alcoholic drink. That was a sort of calming drink in the early morning.
Okay,
early risers. No, that was something like your coffee or whatever.
Oh, I see. Along with coffee and tea. I'd missed that part.
Yeah, it was a drink designed to comfort and warm those who would rise at 4 in the morning to go to their respective tasks, and was a great favourite amongst the street children who would beg passers-by for a sip from their glasses.
We're going to Cambridge, Massachusetts now, and Max is joining us. Hello, Max.
Hi there.
Thanks for calling.
Hello, Mr. Aykroyd.
Hello.
I just had a question regarding Edith Sitwell's book called English Eccentrics.
Yes.
Is this work that she really did in a library, or was it also imagined, for instance, garden hermits, people you'd pay to live in your back garden?
They were real people, okay. That wasn't made up. There was a tradition of hiring hermits or employing hermits to make your gardens more picturesque and more interesting. As for the rest of her book, I really couldn't say. It's been many years since I looked at it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for calling, Max. There's a great character that you introduce us to. This is one of these people who gets all his letter-writing paper by stealing it off the counter at the banks.
Yeah,
and
the
who
famous
has these
miser.
Fits on the street in front of wealthy people's houses. I'm sorry that I forgot his name.
So he could be invited in and asked to dine, thus saving him the cost of a dinner. And in the end, he refused to pay his physician when he was dying because the physician hadn't cured him.
So they tossed cabbage on his coffin as they lowered it.
No, those people are very funny. There's a tradition of, I suppose you'd call it English eccentricity, like the young lady just asked about Edith Sitwell's book on that subject. But there's also a London eccentricity, which is very beguiling, although very awkward sometimes, and sometimes quite harsh eccentricity.
The wartime period, during the 1940, 1941, your examination of the way that Londoners endured the Blitz there. I read for the first time about the dead end kids. These are children who helped put out the fires?
Yes, they were a group of children in the East End who had no ordinary schooling anymore, of course, because the schools had closed down for the duration, and who refused to be sent into the countryside, as many children were. So they formed a kind of unofficial firefighting organization. And whenever a bomb hit their area, or whenever fires were started in the area by bombs, they'd go around in a group and try and put it out. Many of them died, I'm afraid, during the course of their heroic ventures, but there were always children who were willing to take their place. It's a very inspiring story, actually, and it tells you something about the spirit of the East End in particular, one of the most deprived parts of London for most of its history, but one in which the spirit of comradeship and friendship and communal self-help was very thoroughly formed and developed.
You describe it as one of the foulest places on earth in the 19th century, Jack the Ripper being in many ways like a personification of the East End.
Yes, indeed. It was an area where there was no sanitation, where there were tenement slums, where immigrants were forced into hideously unclean quarters, where life was based upon scant wages, scant food and scant clothing. It was said by 19th century commentators that the East End was worse than the interior of an African jungle, and the police never dared venture there. It was an area which was known for lawlessness of various kinds, and in all respects, I suppose it could have been one of the most squalid places on earth, yes.
So connect your sense of that place and that time with the poor people in London today, because one of the things that you do, I find it a fascinating balancing walk that you take us on. There's nothing nostalgic about our look back at the people and their awful circumstances of that time, but there is in your book an affection for their place in your city.
Oh, God, yes. It's almost as if, I can't remember who said that, said to me once, but the tramps are like the guardian angels of London. They are like its soul, its wandering, anonymous soul. As if the shape of the crowds conjured up these people who live on the margins of society, who sleep in one doorway or another. And in a sense, they are the soul of London. They are the guardian spirits of London, because somehow they represent its wandering life, its anonymous life, its restless life, its shiftless life, and also its perilous life. It was, until quite recently, the fact that no life in London was ever very secure, whether from unemployment or whether from disease or whether from attacks in the street. Life was a very perilous business, and for some reason the homeless of today, even the vagrants who go around with dogs just as they did 100 years ago, the vagrants who go around with blankets around their shoulders today just as they did 100 years ago, just as they did 200 years ago, represent a very strong continuity in the city. And for me, the lives of these huddled people represent the presence of the past, as if the past could never wholly be exorcised.
Connection listeners, if you want a taste of more of Peter Ackroyd's prose, the entire first chapter of London, the biography, is on our website. We're found at theconnection.org. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. The London you're hearing about today, is that the London that you know? Do you see the city as something of a villain? Give us a call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection on National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. If you'd like to join in a conversation with the author who is my guest this hour, his name is Peter Ackroyd. His book, and we will hear a little bit of it right now, is called London, the Biography.
Another aspect of its size, therefore, was the fact that it contained everything. When Henry Mayhew ascended above London in a balloon, he observed that vast bricken mass of churches and hospitals, banks and prisons, palaces and workhouses, docks and refuges for the destitute, all blent into one immense black spot. But in such a vast metropolis, forever growing, vice and heroism become themselves unimportant. The sheer size of London creates indifference. The place sits on you, broods on you, stamps on you, said Henry James. This is another aspect of its unimaginable size. It acts as a giant weight or burden upon each individual life and consciousness. It weighs upon the mind. It may lead to desperation or release energy.
That's Peter Ackroyd reading from his book, London, the Biography. Peter, one of the things that I enjoyed a lot in the book is the continuity, the way that when you explore these stones that you describe, you would find that a leper house of 400 or 500 years ago is even today a hospital, despite everything that may have happened in between.
Yes, that kind of continuity is very interesting indeed. And again, it's not a subject which has been thoroughly or properly explored. For example, Richard Whittington, the famous mayor of London, set up some city latrines in a street by a London bridge on the same site today as the Department of Metropolitan Sanitation. There was a vast maypole in one area of London, the biggest maypole in England, and it stood on one site for something like 300 years. On the site today, on the exact same spot, is the Lloyds Building, which is a very tall and magnificent edifice. So there are continuities of a most peculiar kind, and it's something which I tried to explore in some detail in the book, but it's a subject of endless complexity, of immense fascination.
And do you find when you walk in the city that your nose takes you back in time, whether, I mean, if you're in a place where the fish is sold or where the bread is being baked or you know, passing a sewer grate, because you do write about the way that we relate to the city, by the way it smells.
Yes, indeed. The smells of London today are the smells of the Thames, the smells of the underground, smells of buses. Some of the old smells have gone forever. It would be very difficult now to smell fish in London since Billingsgate Market has moved some miles downstream. But you do sense an atmosphere of a place in many other ways. There's almost a preternatural, unconscious sensitivity to areas of London, which only an historian can understand. For example, there's one area of London near Aldersgate Street, which has always been a wasteland. It's now, although a very rich part of London, and now just a car park. But that is the spot where Daniel Defoe writes of a huge burial pit for the victims of the plague. So in a sense, it's always been a doomed spot. And there are other parts of London which exude an atmosphere which can only have existed over many hundreds of years. You feel the presence of a place, you feel the presence of an area in ways which its modern camouflage would not suggest to you, but which seem to seep through in its history.
Our next caller hails from Boston, Massachusetts. Peter is joining us. Hello, Peter. Peter, are you there?
I see a lot of differences.
I think Peter's doing something else as we're speaking right now, so we may go back. But to Truro, Mass, and Richard's joining us. Hi, Richard.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. My question to Mr. Aykroyd has to do with the threatened loss of some colorful traditions, and I guess give you two instances of it. A.E. Houseman's wonderful line, "Give crowns and pounds and guineas, but not your heart away." How would it sound if you said, give euros, but not your heart away? And the other thing is that when we go to London, we always love to go up in the Old Bailey and sit up in the balcony and see all these bewigged personages downstairs. Last time we were there, we heard the judge say, "Well, sir, did you put your hand above or below the knickers?" And it's just a wonderful show. Now, are the Whigs going to go? And
I don't
so,
think
how
the
do
Whigs
you feel about it?
Well, I feel like you do about these things, that in a world which changes so rapidly, it seems absurd to throw overboard things which there's no need to throw overboard. The Whigs, I think, will stay. The ritual will stay. The formality will stay. Whether the pounds and guineas survive is another matter. The guineas, of course, have gone already.
Yeah.
But the pounds may be going in that direction too, which would be a great shame.
Is there a British fascination with things of the past which in any way distinguishes it from the decision of the other European countries to toss their currency out and go ahead with the euro?
Well, how can I put it? Let me put it this way. There is a strong antiquarian streak in the English imagination. That's for sure. It's always been obsessed with history and with biography. It's always been looking back at its historical origins. It's a sort of antiquarian pursuit. It's always been considered to be an English vice almost. In another way, talking about London once more, I'm often asked whether other capital cities have the same resonance. And I have to say to you that when I've talked to French, Italian, Germans, they don't have the same sense of their city at all. They're really not interested in its past or in its presence, in its echoic presence, as I call London. And so I think London is almost unique in that respect, that it conjures up visions of the past and visions of antiquity, even visions of futurity, I suppose. In a way which does not happen in any other city which I can bring to mind.
The only one that I can think of, because it actually crossed my mind as I was reading the book, is perhaps St. Petersburg, and although it's a much younger city.
Yes, that may be right. I'd never thought of that. That's possibly right. But if you go to Athens or Rome, where you might assume that the presence of the past was a great joy or a great source of comfort, you don't see it at all. I think it's probably because London has been so heavily bombed, so much of its past has been erased, that it can only live in the imagination. It makes the imagination stronger when so little survives of its material texture.
We're going to Waltham, and Ken is joining us. Hello, Ken.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I want to share an experience that happened in the mid-80s when I went to London after undergraduate. And I was sitting out on the steps in Kilburn Park, having just rented a flat, and a gentleman walked by from British Guyana. We picked up a friendship. We were both musicians. And within a week, he'd asked if I wanted to look for a flat with him. What he meant by that was a squat. That was an unfamiliar concept to me. And for about a year, I found myself looking for council flats in London, noticing when people had moved out, breaking in through a window in the back, bringing curtains and a lock, and taking part in something called the Squatters' Rights Act, something that we thought was a very noble thing to do.
The council flat is public housing, is that right, Ken?
That's exactly right. In fact, it's mentioned in a number of British folk songs, and I think it was run very poorly in the mid-80s, and what tended to happen was there would be waiting lists of a year or 2 years while flats would sit empty, and this layer of the culture that I found myself involved in took it upon themselves to move in. And we would put a sign on the front door that said, the Squatters' Rights Act of 18-something, and we have the right to occupy this premises. And it felt very noble. It also felt very odd as an American suburbanite to be living in northwest London in this squatting culture. But it was a fascinating way to experience the city.
Peter, back almost to where we began with the people, the priority of the people over the authorities.
Absolutely so. I think that's a very interesting story. I remember that period of London's history very well because I was there at the time, I suppose. No, the people have always had a sort of anarchic, energetic streak. They've always been unwilling to obey laws or obey their betters. Because in London, in a sense, everyone is supposed to be equal. There's such a thing as Cockney humour, which is very deflating humour, and which is always addressed to the so-called upper classes. And it's that spirit of London, that Cockney cheerfulness and bravado, which I think still survives in many parts of the city.
Do you know whether the culture of squatting survives through the
I believe it does. I don't think it's on such a large scale anymore, but I'm sure there will still be examples of it.
I mean, it was by the hundreds in Camden Town and
Sweet Park. Yeah.
And it was easy to find yourself only in the company of people who were squatting. You could spend days and weeks and only meet people who were doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's right.
Ken, thanks so much for your call.
Sure, thank you for taking it.
We're going to Columbia, South Carolina. James is joining us. Hello, James.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Okay, I'm probably out of the picture from what you guys are talking about, but I'm fascinated at listening to the gentleman talk. I was talking to a friend of mine about some of the history, and in 1914, in the First World War, I believe it was in Christmas, and the Germans and the British actually stopped the fighting to celebrate Christmas. And my friend shared with me, told me that that Londoners were the first British out of the trenches. And I just thought I'd ask and ask the gentleman to comment on it.
Well, I think that is a true story. I think they sang Silent Night. Is that not right?
I've heard that as well.
Yeah. And it's quite likely that the Londoners were the first out of the trenches because they were proportionally the much largest part of the armed forces at the time. So I think your story is quite correct.
Do you think, let me take it a little bit further, James, if I can, because I want to ask Peter whether or not you think that the First World War, and perhaps even the Second World War more so, in some way changed the way that the rest of the world sees London. That good night, good luck, stiff upper lip, that to me is so rooted in that time. I wonder if you found the continuity, the traces of it that preceded that.
Yeah, it's true that the image of London, especially during the Blitz, I suppose, is one that created a kind of myth about London's invincibility. Of course, it wasn't invincible. About a quarter of it was destroyed. 1/8 of its population killed, I believe. But the bravado was genuine. The stiff upper lip was genuine. And I think that has to do with folk memories of earlier devastations. The Great Fire of London and the Great Plague are two of the enduring folk myths of the city, in a sense. They're something which every Londoner knows about. And I suppose, in a sense, that the Cockney phrase about Hitler, Hitler's bombs were, we can take it. The unexpressed opinion was that we've taken it all before, so we can take it again.
I want to take the liberty of just reading the last few lines of the book and asking you about it. Peter, you close your biography of London with these words: "These relics of the past now exist as part of the present. It is in the nature of the city to encompass everything. So when it is asked how London can be a triumphant city when it has so many poor and so many homeless, it can only be suggested that they, too, have always been a part of its history. Perhaps they are part of its triumph. If this is a hard saying, then it is only as hard as London itself. London goes beyond any boundary or convention. It contains every wish or word ever spoken, every action or gesture ever made, every harsh or noble statement ever expressed. It is illimitable. It is infinite London." That's a nice piece of writing. Well done.
Thank you.
There's an edge to that which leaves me thinking, as I read it and as I read it just now, that you're very well aware of the fact that your biography of London is a work in progress. The city will go well beyond the moment that you've marked on these pages.
Oh, goodness, yes. The phrase infinite London, which I use, I borrowed from William Blake, who saw in London the outlines of eternity. So in that sense, that the history of London is not over. I entitle the chapter from which you read those words, "Resurgam, I Will Arise." That comes from The Building of St. Paul's by Sir Christopher Wren. He wanted a central stone to mark the dome's height, I suppose, and this workman picked up a stone slab from a corner in a pile of rubble, and it was part of a gravestone. It said, "Resurgam, I will arise again." And Wren used that as the linchpin of his building, but it's also a very apt symbol for the city itself, which is continually recreating itself.
And wandering as you did back through the centuries and over all the geography of the city, did you find a time and a place that you wish you had or could live in?
I would only find my own time and my own place, the most appropriate ones. I don't think it's wise or just to try and become part of another century. My own century is quite enough for me.
Peter, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure.
Peter Aykroyd, my guest. His latest book is called London, The Biography. We had help producing our program this hour from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Tim Monroe, Brian Myers, and Carl Walker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugarts. Our intern is Jill Teitelman. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.